I'd like to thank each of the four speakers for both their focused and very informative talks. And because you have been so good at keeping on time, or because I've been so good at keeping you on time, that we have, I believe, about half an hour for a question period. So I'll invite the four speakers and Gordon Hickey to come up to the main table now.
Thank you, Tim. So while you think about questions you might like to ask our speakers, I'll just share a few notes I made to remind us of what was spoken about. We had Thomas Pasek telling us about the importance of smallholder farmers to international food security and how his organization is working hard on many fronts to address both challenges and opportunities to improve food security amongst these very important and vulnerable farming groups and communities, and that issues such as climate, nutrition, and gender are absolutely central to that group moving forward. Another key thing that was mentioned in his presentation was the importance of scalability and sustainability, which needs to be in the centre of our mind as we work on addressing food security-related problems. Then we had Dolph Lintello, quite an interesting and entertaining presentation about the importance, I think, of political commitment and the need to improve transparency and accountability around our international agencies and communities to allow democratic processes to play their part in food security, and the power of reputation and the potential to ruin reputation is a very good motivator of governments. Then we have Mark Fryers tell us about how important it is to consider nutrition in food security, and I think that was the slam dunk message. I think it is part of food security, but I think it's often forgotten. So I completely agree that the nutrition aspect is central and needs to be better brought to the fore. And he discussed the challenge, really, of evidence of impact, especially when there's timelines associated with interventions and effects confounding and problematizing our ability to report on success and make, capture success stories for politicians to continue funding this kind of work. And the need for more research in nutrition sensitive approaches to food security. And finally, we have the Honourable Michelle Chansey tell us about the urgency of the food security problem in Haiti and the challenges that face the government and the community there and the international community that seeks to assist. And the strategies that are being developed at the moment to address these challenges. So that's what we heard in a nutshell. We've got some questions. I think we're going to follow the same sort of format. So maybe we'll have three or four questions. We can keep them fairly short, or a comment, keep it fairly short. Please introduce your name, your agency, and if there's a particular person that you'd like to respond to the question. Thanks. We'll start here.
Jim Cornelius with the Canadian Food Grains Bank, and I want to pick up on some of the remarks of Dolph, but also what others have said. And it's a bit more of a comment than a question. As the index indicates, Canada has been doing well in the food security and nutrition side in terms of being a donor. It's a food security and nutrition is a priority of the aid program, including a whole range from food assistance to nutrition interventions to agriculture development. There's been substantial increases in investment in agriculture. And this has been a long-term program. It's been going on for quite some time in Canada. And so that's the good news. The challenge always, of course, is to sustain this support. And particularly in a context where aid dollars are declining. Yesterday, some of us met with the new Christine Peridi, the new Minister for International Development, and a key message that we had for him was that stay with the program. Because it's always a danger when you get new ministers is they always want to have their own stamp on a program and move to some new strategy. And so it was a critical message that Canada is doing well, performance is good, but please stay with the program. And we need, I think, collectively, this is where the call for action is. it's very easy to be critical of governments, but if they don't get praise when they're doing well, then their tendency is to move to other things. And we really do need to be getting the message very strongly that we're doing well, but don't, it's not a short term, don't solve it in 3 years or 5 years. So it becomes really important that we find ways to do that. At the same time, we need to make sure that in 2 years we could have a change of government. Who knows? And that when you have changes of government, there's always the danger that what you were doing well before is the old government, and we've got to do something new. It's the same issues. And what's, I think, going to be critical is that we need to be having the message that Canada, it's Canada. It's not a political party. It's not a particular government. But it's Canada that is doing well, because this goes well back to previous governments. And that needs that it's a Canada brand. And this becomes really part of what we're doing. And so the call to action here is for all of us to be getting that message to the government and to the Liberal Party and the NDP, that this is a key thing that Canada is doing and the world is doing well, and we need to stay at it. And so students, others here, let's just get that message over and over again. Using the index is a good thing to start with. And our partners from overseas, Burhanu, Atul Burhanu, he needs to be giving that message to people as well. So that's my comment.
Thank you for sharing. Call to arms. Anyone, Dolph, did you have a comment in response to that, a short comment?
Very briefly. I mean, of course, I like sort of your appreciation of the work that we do, and I could not agree more with you on sort of the importance of, you know, Brand Canada. In the long term, we cannot, aid is not going to be the solution. We all know that, and we know that the aid climate is sort of slowly sort of, you know, it's becoming a smaller pie. So, but indices like the HANSE actually sort of also, the key thing about them is sort of by generating these dynamics of sort of democratic societies holding governments to account in developing countries as well. And that really is the key sort of over the longer term. We want, of course, developing countries themselves to be sort of financing their own social protection programs, their own nutrition interventions. And I think the international community is also increasingly working towards that. So, for instance, the Sun is now looking, increasingly trying to see to what extent sort of governments in the Sun program are themselves contributing to its nutrition interventions and not just depending over time on aid only.
Thank you. Next question from over here.
Thank you. My name is Roland. I come from Wageningen University in Holland. My question is addressed to Honorable Chancy. You talked about the milk sector in Haiti, and you mentioned difficulty to take over, and you talked about $60 million of importation of milk. And can you share with us about the legal framework of buying or selling milk in IT? Can, I guess the legal framework might have implication in the actual what happened right now. Thank you.
So that's a big question. In a few words, as best you can, about the legal framework underpinning the milk. Yeah. Do you need it? No. Okay.
Why this question? Because the legal framework is not the obstacle now. The more what we need is more investment to give the producer the possibility to sell his milk. No electricity, no roads. And we need some building to make small units to process the milk. And this program is supporting by the government, by the university. We can make the what it's we need to give quality control and. In Haiti, we have many laws, but the problem is not it's to apply it and to use the opportunities. And but what is the idea Quelle est votre préoccupation par rapport à ça?
Je vais aller en français.
Merci.
En Hollande, on a travaillé beaucoup sur l'aspect théorique travailler sur la sécurité alimentaire. Qu'il faut travailler sur un concept qu'on a appelé système d'innovation. C'est pas seulement la technologie qui importe, c'est pas seulement le développement de la qualité du lait, mais aussi le cadre institutionnel qui entoure la qualité du lait. Et il y a des preuves ailleurs en Afrique, par exemple, où le cadre légal importe aussi beaucoup. C'est pour ça que je posais cette question. Je vous demandais quel est le cadre légal autour du lait, de la vente du lait, de l'activité de la production du lait en Haïti. Parce que si vous travaillez sur ce cadre, cela peut fouetter davantage le secteur du lait en Haïti et en faire plutôt un secteur qui produit de la richesse.
OK, so we'll hold that question and discussion, some clarification. Yeah. We'll go to another question on this side.
That's an interesting noise. My name's Felix von Geyer. I'm a freelance sustainable development journalist. Petit point pour Michel Chantier avant que je pose une question chez Marc et Dolph. J'ai toujours pensé que la raison pour l'écrasement d'agricole en Haïti, c'était à cause des Américains qui ont dumpé tout à fait beaucoup de leur riz sur le marché. C'est fini le marché. Et alors, après ça, tout le monde est migré au Port-au-Prince. But the question for Marc and Dolph is you've really addressed the parameters of politics here. And I remember listening to Hillary Clinton speaking when she was Secretary of State in 2009 saying development is now officially part of American foreign policy, and that includes the drive against hunger. And she was particularly targeting the African farmers. And a few months after, the Chinese ambassador to the UN Geneva also made a big statement about the need for sustainable development, particularly in agriculture overseas. So with the Go Abroad policy of China, we've got Go Abroad policies coming from Middle Eastern countries. What kind of can sovereign countries do to actually mobilize that, to actually try and get more investment and attention given to their own food insecurity and nutritional insecurity issues? Thank you.
Thank you. So that question covered a number of speakers. We'll take one more question, and then we'll let the group speak to that previous comment and this question.
Noah Solomon from Guatemala. I have a comment that would be covered, cover one of the speakers.
Okay.
My comment's inspired by the title, the rephrasing of the title of Mark Fryers with regard to global food and nutrition. And it needed to be said, in relationship to the keynote address we had last night. And I want to phrase my comment in terms of the paradigm of necessary but not sufficient. Clearly, Marco alerted us to, in his perception, a danger, and a danger of not having enough food so that we will have a problem of hunger. But solving that problem of hunger, and I think Mark's point is we still would not have solved our problem of nutrition, which means, in fact, nutrients. And you've given various scenarios of how nutrients can get on the plate where there is enough food, either by enriching the food or fortifying the food at some point. So I want to take that one more step and talk about global food and nutrition and nutritional status. Again, in this concept of necessary but not sufficient. And I was troubled a bit, Mark, by the linkage of stunting and malnutrition, 165 million children, because of malnutrition. Well, it's because they don't retain their nutrients or utilize them that they are indeed stunted. But putting all of the food plus all of the necessary nutrients on the table, in my opinion, that I can't justify at this time, would not reverse that stunting. So the troublesome issue is the linkage between stunting and malnutrition, understood as not having solved the nutrients problem, which is debatable scientifically and in policy.
Thank you very much. Because that was a comment and because we only have one more person standing, and that was, I think, directed at Mark, please share your question and then we'll open the discussion.
Thank you. Susan Robertson from the International Development Research Center. This is a question to Dolph about the index. interesting to see the league tables, the top ranking. Of course, it's nice to be near the top of the tables. The downside of an index is that you don't get a sense of the absolute performance of different countries on the list, whether or not there's a significant difference between rankings and whether or not those at the top are actually performing or they're simply the best of the worst. So if you could elaborate on that, thanks.
Okay, that's a good one to end it on. So let's start with Michel, please.
Alors pour la question des causes, on pourrait dire, de la dégradation accélérée de l'agriculture haïtienne, il y a trois causes. La première cause, c'est que depuis l'indépendance en 1804, l'agriculture repose sur des petites exploitations familiales qui ont généré de la richesse, mais toute cette richesse a été emportée par des spéculateurs, des importateurs, exportateurs, et cette richesse n'est jamais retournée pour moderniser et pour appuyer le développement de cette agriculture, qui s'est essoufflée après 200 ans, et qui s'est essoufflée dans tous les sens, décapitalisée, morcelée et dégradation de l'environnement. La deuxième cause, c'est qu'effectivement, dans les années 80, Haïti est devenu le champion du libéralisme et a été le premier pays à éliminer toutes les barrières tarifaires. Et cela a causé effectivement une distorsion sur le marché et qui a mis fin, on pourrait dire, à l'autosuffisance de 80% que nous avions, dans la misère, mais que nous avions, et qui aujourd'hui fait que le pays est entièrement dépendant à la fois des importations, mais des importations qui sont financées par les paysans pauvres qui ont laissé le pays et qui ont émigré et qui renvoient de l'argent maintenant pour nourrir leur famille à 55% de la consommation. Et la troisième cause, c'est qu'aujourd'hui, le modèle de solution adopté, basé essentiellement sur l'aide internationale, ne casse pas le cercle vicieux de la dépendance alimentaire. Au contraire, même si nous sommes d'accord sur les stratégies, nous sommes d'accord sur les causes, nous sommes d'accord sur la vision de ce qu'il y a à faire, institutionnellement, la cacophonie qui existe entre les agences, entre les ONG, font qu'aujourd'hui, les ressources sont très mal utilisées. Les ressources humaines sont complètement écartelées. Les cadres haïtiens laissent toutes les institutions parce qu'il y a une compétition pour les cadres haïtiens. La plupart ont laissé le pays, 83%, et ceux qui sont restés sont ponctionnés dans les institutions haïtiennes, qu'elles soient gouvernementales ou nationales, et même du secteur privé, pour travailler dans les projets qui sont éphémères, et des projets qui bouffent les ressources à 75% avant que un peu d'argent arrive sur le terrain. Et malgré les bonnes intentions des agences et des programmes, mais ces programmes d'abord assurent leur propre survie et leur reproduction, et finalement, ce qui en bénéficie le pays est très pauvre. Et donc, non seulement être pauvre, mais aussi désarticule la capacité nationale de donner une réponse. Il faut que nous, ensemble, nous trouvions d'autres voies pour le développement et d'autres types de financement également, parce que l'aide internationale, comme elle est structurée dans un pays comme Haïti, perpétue le cycle de la dépendance alimentaire et le cycle de la dépendance à l'aide elle-même.
Merci. You had a few questions, one linked perhaps. Would you like to respond to anything?
There's one which was shared, sort of, I think.
Yes,
and
I think so.
I'd like to give Mark the opportunity perhaps to answer, because okay, it is a little bit outside of the realm of my sort of expertise. But
I'm not really sure it's in mine either, but okay. I will try. This was really one more about inward investment, I guess, if I understood the correction correctly from Felix, and what can countries do to perhaps do more to address their own sort of food and nutrition insecurity in the face of inward investment, particularly in commercial agriculture. What I point to, I think, in what I've seen around the world is high-level championship is particularly important for prioritizing nutrition on the national agenda. So if we look at the examples of Brazil and the leadership first of Fernando Henrique in Brazil, and followed by Lula, on the different programs. I won't run through all the names because I can't remember them, but the most famous one is Bolsa Familia, and which started from the Bolsa Escola under Fernando Henrique, and then produced the well-known program which really prioritized both hunger and nutrition and their alleviation in Brazil. That worked, in my opinion, because of for a range of reasons, but partly because of very, very high level championship and continued championship. We've had a couple of examples today from Senegal, and it's another country where we've seen the government deliberately place nutrition leadership in the Prime Minister's office, so right high up, so that they can drive interdepartmental collaboration around prioritizing nutrition on the agenda. Ethiopia, as I mentioned earlier, is another country that has placed nutrition high up on the political agenda there too. And I think where we see that happening, that's where we see the scope to include nutrition and the consequences for nutrition outcomes in negotiations on inward investment deals or indeed any other sort of agricultural investment area. So, my answer in short would be, focus on securing high-level champions for food and nutrition security and use that in the process of negotiation.
Thomas, I wondered, do you have anything to add to that from an international perspective?
No, because this is something that we at EFAD actually track quite closely. It's a good question and an important one, and I fully agree with Mark. I think that's absolutely right. I think there are two things to say about it. One is that where the means are available, domestic investment in agriculture makes a huge difference because it attracts a lot of other investments, external and internal, be it from the private sector, et cetera. And then in situations where the resources may be lacking, where a country may not have the resources to invest themselves, demonstrated incredible commitment goes a long way to attracting investment, et cetera, and to bringing the agriculture sector along. Not that this is necessarily the case in Nigeria, because there are significant resources, but I think that's an example of a country that has really made it very clear that they're taking their own agriculture very seriously.
Any other thoughts on that? So I think that actually leads into the question that was asked about performance sort of on paper versus in reality and whether you're really able to capture success. Can you share your thoughts on that?
Yes, most certainly. Some very sharp questions, actually, which I couldn't quite address in the talk given sort of the short sort of amount of time at hand. You're asking questions about methodology and sort of implications of those. In terms of are we able to assess absolute performance, the methodological answer here is because we're looking at indicators which are measured on quite different scales, you cannot easily add them up and come to some sort of a composite score. The way around that is by ranking countries on each of those indicators and give them a score accordingly. So we can actually very clearly establish the difference between the performance of countries between number one and two in terms of an absolute score and between two and three. And whereas the ranking might only be a difference of one in this case, there might actually, in terms of absolute performance, the difference might be bigger. But all that can be seen sort of in the reports, and we've got quite a lovely website, www.hancindex.org, hancindex.org, where I would encourage you, whoever is interested, to have a look, because all the reports is there, all the data is there. We got some very good sort of testimonies from communities, particularly in the countries that we work, the developing country communities that we work in. The second part of the... So you can also actually look at each of the indicators itself to see what the absolute performance is. So again, that will give you sort of give you an insight. The second question was, fantastic. We kind of doing second. Are we actually the best or the worst? Very sharp insight again. Sort of we are comparing within this set of countries, and if everybody is really poorly, there's still going to be a number one or a number two. It doesn't mean they're doing brilliant. Sharply observed. But I think the question here really is the cup half full or half empty? Depends on how you want to look at that. You could actually just as well argue, is Canada amongst the best of the best? So I'd like to leave that question up to sort of the Canadians.
Well, maybe some other people on the panel have some views or insights on this discussion about impact and performance of international aid and development work on food security.
I might just pitch in with the thought that I haven't got a picture of it, but if we looked at the graph of investment in nutrition compared to other things over the last 20 years, nutrition tends to flatline and bounce along the bottom of the graph at a very, very low level of investment. So that there is only room for growth, I would say, in that side of things. So it's not that it's the worst of the best of the worst, was it? But there is definitely room for improvement in the overall quantum of investment in this area. And it's to everybody's benefit. This is the thing. It's actually great returns on that investment, which I think is a message we all have to give to economists and policy influencers and policy leaders so that they can pay more attention, I think, through that championship point I made earlier as well.
Can I comment sort of on one point raised by Noel, which I thought actually it was an observation, I think it's a very important one. Even if we have sufficient food available and sufficient nutritious food available, there is no surety that everybody will be sufficiently fed. And this is all back to the politics of what's happening within households, within communities, who's actually having entitlements, effective entitlements to nutritious food. I see you nodding. No, that wasn't the point you wanted.
Right. But it's an important one. My point is that, assuming even that they're all well fed, they won't necessarily be all tall and perfect, because nutrients can be lost due to environmental stresses after they've been consumed and absorbed.
So,
I think, is the next frontier. But I'm happy at this meeting.
Can I just respond?
Yeah, I mean, to some extent we're talking there about the complexity of the challenge and the interlinked dimensions.
So very briefly, your point is very right. Sort of having sort of environments within which people live with good sanitation conditions is a critical factor. And actually, some of my colleagues, sort of Professor Robert Chambers, sort of is now working on understanding some of the missing parts of the discussion around sanitation. The focus is very much on diarrhea, but actually there might be various other infections going on in the guts of people on a routine basis that we have no idea whatsoever what actual effects they have in terms of lack of absorption of those nutrients that you put in your mouth and get in your stomach. But so nutritious and sanitary environments are absolutely critical factor. And when we look at sort of most of the countries in our sort of developing country index for HANSI, we see the nutrition rates are, the sanitation rates are dreadful, really dreadful, and they are a big drag on better outcomes of stunting and food security.
Thank you.
Thank you for answering.
So one last comment or question?
Just about the program with Moringa Olifera we have in Haiti. We just make a network with all NGOs working in Moringa and with the Ministry of Education. We are starting this year a national program in the schools for to use the Moringa like a pedagogical tool for science and for the children to understand how this plant can be used for the nutritional complement. And 5 ministers are involved, health, agriculture, environmental, and education, and Ministry of Human Rights. And it is a national program. We have some Moringa septic, like the World Food Program, like the World Health Organization, but we believe in this, and we have other proof that it's can be a good and accessible tool to fight against malnutrition. If our people and this tree is in Haiti, many people knows, many people has the tree in near the house, and it's an educational program. It's another way to fight against malnutrition without fortification, but each people can take is goal for of nutrition with a tools and other local products.
Thank you. So we've ended in a place that I'm very happy with, which is that it's a highly complex challenge and that it's going to take integrated approaches and multidisciplinary and all the good things that we're here to discuss. Please, before we thank the speakers, I'd just like to say that we will be breaking for lunch and we'll be returning here back at 1 p.m. For the keynote address. Because Professor Jumo needs to be able to have lunch, we'd like to invite Professor Jumo and Professor Manardis to get their meal before the rest of us, and we'll all line up behind them. But please, that was a very, I think, rich and enjoyable session. We had some very interesting speakers, so please join me in thanking them for their contribution. Oh yes, please. While you're eating your lunch, take advantage of the posters that we have on the wall, research posters. The authors of the posters will be hopefully standing near them and able to have a chat if you're interested. Okay.